Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. And we've come to the end of our second season, so we're honouring, well, ourselves, this week by taking a deep dive into 1967's made-for-TV bona fide Beatles adventure, Magical Mystery Tour, which was loosely directed and even more loosely written by the band themselves. And if we have calculated our schedule correctly, this episode has been released on what is the 55th anniversary of the original broadcast of that movie, airing as it did on BBC One on Boxing Day. Although it initially received a critical mauling, which many put down to this trippy, psychedelic, visually outlandish film being shown in black and white, it was repeated 10 days later in full colour on BBC Two and got much the same reaction. So it marks the Beatles' first major critical failure, but like so much of the group's output during their career, was it just ahead of its time? So Ed, first question for you. Given that all film appreciation, to some extent, is largely subjective, and therefore it could be argued that the only true measure of a film's value is how much it realises the filmmaker's original artistic vision, does this movie live up to Paul McCartney's doodle of a circle and some scribbles?
Oh, it more than lives up to it, I would say. I mean, in terms of the films I've seen that were literally planned on a piece of paper with a circle and no script, yeah, I mean, it's right up there with the best of them, I would say. I think it is fair to say that the whole thing is a bit ramshackle. I don't think that's a big surprise to anyone. I think at the same time, the interesting thing about it is that this is probably the first thing they ever did that had absolutely no commercial interest in it whatsoever, other than the fact that it was being shown on the BBC primetime at Christmas. That is a sort of commercial venture for sure, but the actual piece of art itself, no one in it is trying to further the Beatles brand at all.
I
don't think so at all. I mean, yeah, there's it's kind of significant that this is the first thing they've done since Brian Epstein died. And that there was almost a feeling of, I'm not going to say being let off the leash, because I don't think he was, you know, he had them on a leash, but certainly he was one of the people, probably the main person in the room, who was trying to make them behave commercially to some degree or another. Certainly later on, I think there are things about specific songs where this is particularly pertinent. But yeah, for me, there's a reason this was so unpopular at the time, and that's because they weren't trying to entertain anybody, perhaps for the first time in their career.
So do you think that was, I guess I kind of always assumed that the nature of this film, the nature of the songs that they're recording at this time, was just like a natural evolution for the band. But I guess I kind of thought that the band assumed the fans would follow them on that journey. Do you think it was conscious, a conscious artistic move on their part, that when they released this film in particular, obviously, but you know, I guess some of the music choices that they made along the way, that they saw it more as an artistic endeavor that actually they knew was going to possibly isolate themselves from the fans or from public opinion at the time?
I'm not sure how deliberate a move to... Well, certainly, you know, they weren't sort of consciously trying to alienate fans or anything like that, I don't think. But I think certainly there's a point in John Lennon's career when he certainly stopped trying to entertain an audience and very, very deliberately started trying to provoke his audience. And I think I Am the Walrus is the sort of, when I was watching their performance of I Am the Walrus and this, I thought, oh, this is the point for him, isn't it? This is the point at which he is not, he's not trying to, there's nothing of sort of Beatle John in this at all. He is, it's nuts and it's challenging and there are bits of it that are quite unsettling. But I think even, you know, Paul, who's kind of always traditionally seen as the most commercially minded one, this is largely his baby, right? I mean, it's, you know, he's the one who's kind of driving it, if reports are to be believed. And, you know, this is not a sort of watchable, you know, family Christmas time viewing, even with, you know, supposedly cuddly Paul McCartney at the helm of it. You know, something very different is going on here, and it's not an accident.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I guess one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about was, I think that one of the justifications, not even justification, one of the arguments put forward for why this film didn't seem to land with its audience at the time was down to the band's hubris. And, you know, this sort of general belief that everything they touched turned to gold, you know, no matter what they did, it was always absolutely brilliant. This is just coming off the back of Sgt. Pepper's, although I think they started recording the title track for this and started had the idea for the film before that album was released. But obviously, certainly up until that point, I think that there was a reason for the band to believe that they were just, everything they did was absolutely brilliant and it was going to receive a huge critical acclaim. It hadn't really occurred to me that the other side of that argument, which might be that they might be deliberately doing something which they knew was going to come across as controversial. So I guess the question is, how much of that is down to sort of, you know, too much self-confidence, and how much is it is them being self-aware?
Well, I'm not sure it's either particularly. I think it's more that they're just sort of interested in different things now, and they're more interested in the avant-garde, and they're less interested in the confines of pop music and what pop music can achieve. But you know, I mean, make no mistake, these are largely pop songs. But certainly as we understand them to be now. But I mean, listening to, I suppose Beatles fans had already heard Tomorrow Never Knows, so they'd already had things that were weird, if you like. Sergeant Pepper is not a particularly weird album in that regard. There's nothing particularly avant-garde on it. I suppose Within You, Without You might have been thought a bit out there, but generally speaking, those are quite accessible songs. Like I say, I mean, I Am the Walrus is just nuts, and it's very, very challenging. And Blue Jay Way as well is almost pretty defiantly not trying to be a particularly sort of engaging tune, if you know what I mean. It's sort of built on a drone, and yeah. And I really like Blue Jay Way, but yeah, it is it's not catchy, you know.
yeah. I think that it is easily forgotten that the film, the approach to the film seems to be to simply showcase some of their new material. So these are 6 new songs and not much going on between them, but what happens in between them is what makes it seem very surreal and a bit, you know, outlandish and a bit out there. But first and foremost, they are showcasing 6 new songs, and there's, you know, we can talk quite a lot about, I think, the idea that part of the rationale for that was that they decided to quit touring, so they thought that actually they could create a film like this that could do the tour for them, essentially, you know, that, you know, tour via TV and get the songs out that way, which makes sense to me. And I think that it's easily forgotten that those 6 songs are the true points of the movie. So when you say, like, you know, I Am the War is obviously quite out there, Blue Jay Way is quite out there, Flying, am I correct in thinking that's their first instrumental at this point?
Yes, I guess it would
be. Yeah, it would be, yeah. And that's quite a unique thing. But, I guess we should probably talk about the film in terms of the music first, because it's, you know, they have these 6 songs. These are the ones that they want to showcase, and they built everything around these 6. Do you think the film comes out of that? Do you think the film comes out of the style of the songs?
No, I think the film is completely divorced from the songs.
Do you? Okay.
the songs just kind of happen. I mean, the key thing I think about Magical Mystery Tour is, like, this is the only Beatles film in which the Beatles, the characters in the film that the Beatles are playing, don't exist as a band or an entity, you know. So Ringo plays a character who is called Richard B. Starkey. The rest of them are not named. No one says this is John or this is Paul or this is George. They're just guys on the coach, and then they play other characters as they go through. But the Beatles do not exist in Magical Mystery Tour. It's the only Beatles film where that's the case. So even in Yellow Submarine, I'm not sure they're referred to as the Beatles, but they are all called John, Paul, George and Ringo. And obviously in Help and A Hard Day's Night, they are playing the characters of the band. So what this means is that, like, narratively, it just sort of occupies a wholly different space from all the others, because all the others acknowledge their existence and they work around it, or at least within the framework of them being a band. Magical Mystery Tour, it ignores the idea that the Beatles are famous. It doesn't play on that. It doesn't sort of further their mythos through any kind of narrative. And the only song that they are seen to perform as a band in the whole thing is I Am the Walrus. The rest of them are, they're kind of like music videos, really, that don't really have any connection to the rest of the film. So I don't really agree with the idea that the film is sort of built around the songs. The songs are kind of in there incidentally. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe we kind of end up at the same place, really.
Yeah. It's interesting because from what you just said there, it touches on 2 of the things I wanted to raise, and I'm already, this feels inevitable when talking about this film, but already I feel like I'm about to contradict myself when we're 15 minutes in, right? But I feel like, first of all, you think that the film is divorced from the songs, but one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was that I felt like it's interesting to me that the footage of the songs in this film, for me, are inseparable from the audio of the songs themselves. So I listen to I Am the Walrus. I cannot help but think about the segment in this film where they are performing that song. Same goes Fool on the Hill. Same goes for Your Mother Should Know. Those are just, they are absolutely inseparable. And to that extent, because of the Beatles' lore and their place in sort of, you know, public consciousness, the film itself is iconic. Like 100%, there's no doubt that those segments within the film themselves are absolutely iconic. They are indelible as part of the Beatles catalogue. So first of all, if we just touch on that for now, so I think that the idea of the film and the songs going hand in hand is an interesting discussion point for me, because it feels like the Beatles were trying to create something that they felt like they could tour, or they feel like could do the tour for them. So it was supposed to be a showcase for the songs, but the film came after the songs were written, or, you know, in what way do you think they were divorced from the actual album soundtrack?
I mean that they're divorced from the film in that they don't happen at all within the actual.
You mean they're not part of the narrative?
That's what I mean. Yeah, they're not part of the narrative. You know, so even in, even in Help, we kind of touched on a similar thing with Help. This idea that, you know, when we think of You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, we think of them sitting in that house performing the song to Eleanor Bront, right? And there's a similar thing in Help with Ticket to Ride. It's basically a music video. They're not performing the song. It's just happening while they're skiing, you know. At least in that, the Beatles are in the Alps for a narrative reason, you know.
So I Am the Walrus is clearly at least performed in the same, like, airstrip where a lot of the film takes place.
Yeah, true.
And Your Mother Should Know brings everyone together at the end. It feels like it does, you know, it's very, very, like, you used the perfect word earlier, ramshackle. But this idea of there being some kind of climactic end to the movie does bring together all of the characters from the bus together into one room, and you see you see everyone together. And also there's that recurring image of everyone just laughing in the room. This one gigantic square image of like 100-odd people. And every single time I see that, I can always pick out Mao and no one else.
Yes, me too. And I wonder actually whether before Get Back, I wonder whether I did or not. Or maybe I did and I just thought, I kind of knew who Mao was, I guess, but he wouldn't have been so identifiable.
It was the opposite for me, because when I saw Get Back, I was aware of who Mao was as a person, as a figure. When I first saw Get Back, I instantly recognised him as the person I recognised from Magical Mystery Tour. Because I have memories of, it feels like ages ago now, but I have memories of watching Magical Mystery Tour where I knew Mao as just a big guy in glasses and a smart suit that is always in this movie. But so there are songs in the film that, even though they don't feel like they fit in with any kind of narrative, not the film that has one. And I think Paul on his director's commentary for the movie, director's commentary with air quotation marks heavily applied, he talks about how there was no plot. In fact, actually, have you seen, you know, that there's that interview with David Frost that he did after the film was broadcast and had such a critical backlash?
Right, where he's sort of defending it on TV, isn't he?
Yes,
I have seen it, but not for a while.
Yeah, so he says on that, basically, like, the idea was, why does a film have to have a plot? Like, there's no need for, you know, we just approach this as, like, a film doesn't have to have a plot. That's the way we sort of approached it. Mm-hmm. So you know, that kind of, like, falls into this this argument, I guess, that the songs are as much of the movie as they need to be, because the movie itself doesn't have any kind of narrative or plot.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I think, in anthology, like, you know, McCartney is still, you still see he's slightly defensive about it, even 30 years later. And he says, look, I justify Magical Mystery Store by saying that's the only place you see a performance of I Am the Walrus. You know, that alone is worth the price of admission, you know. And he's right, of course. You know, it is artistically valid. And it's good as well, by the way. Like, I enjoy it. It's a bit frustrating to watch, but you know, it's only 53 minutes long. You know, it's not like you're sitting through 3 hours of sort of really, really intense avant-garde, art film stuff. It's a weird mad romp.
That's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because I think it gets talked about in those terms a lot. Like, this is like the Beatles going full on avant-garde, but actually you had to remember that a good 10 minutes of its 53 runtime is given over to what is just basically a depiction of a strip show. You know, there isn't much in the way of artistic, like, there's not much in the way of artistic barriers being pushed there when you're just basically watching what is a striptease or happen on stage. And John enthusiastically clapping, open-eyed, you know, at the thing.
He's very enthusiastic about the stripper scene.
I feel like that's when he gets most into character.
Yeah.
One of the other things I wanted to talk to you about was Paul is... I've heard him mention this a few times, just around this movie, around how Steven Spielberg has quoted the film as being an influence and as being a film that I think what Paul has said in an interview, and forgive me, I forget which one, but he has mentioned in the interview before that Steven Spielberg has said that in film school, Magical Mystery Tour was a film that made everyone sort of stand up and take notice.
Yeah, he said, he said, when I was in film school, that was a film we really took notice of.
So Steven Spielberg said that.
So according to Paul, yes.
Yes. And that was my point, because
what he says is, people like Spielberg have since said.
Right, okay. Because my point was, I actually think that absolutely rings true to me. That feels like the kind of thing that generation of filmmaker would take notice of, that movie, and take lessons and, you know, and learnings from. But I've never heard Spielberg say anything like that. And not to say that I've seen or read or heard every interview that Spielberg's ever given, but, you know, I'm kind of relatively in tune with sort of film stuff and filmmakers interviews and all that kind of stuff. The only corroboration I have of that this ever took place is Paul having said this at least three times in an interview. and like you say, yeah, it's people like Steven Spielberg, people like the greatest filmmaker of all time, have said previously that.
Yeah, it's some people like that. Yeah,
exactly.
That's as far as he'll go.
There is a however, I did I was looking at a few things before this recording, but I do, you know, I don't want to take too much away from Paul there, because I do actually believe that would have happened, and maybe, who knows, maybe it's something that Spielberg said to him personally, but I can imagine that it would have had a massive impact on that generation of filmmakers, up and coming filmmakers around the 70s. And in looking at certain sort of materials in the run-up to this episode, I uncovered that there was a 2012 PBS documentary that was made about the film Magical Mystery Tour. And in that, Martin Scorsese actually makes the point that, in defense of the film, he says something along the lines of, you have to remember that professionalism and polish and politeness are things that people expect from films, but that's only a choice. Like, there are other ways to go. So the criticism that can be aimed at this film, actually, you could argue, is still very subjective, because we're, from a filmic point of view, actually, who's to say that it has to be one way or the other? Which I thought was actually quite important in terms of, like, bring it back to the basics of any film is kind of like a form of art in itself, and perhaps people could be judging it in the wrong way.
Yeah, for sure. And no, it's a really good point. And that's a very good way that he puts it. You know, it is only a choice. And perhaps, you know, films like this, again, it's one of the things about the Beatles in introducing things to the mainstream that were previously only existed in bohemian or avant-garde circles. And the idea that a film didn't necessarily need to have a plot is arguably one of them. I'm not saying that, you know, it's obviously not true that no one else had done a film like Magical Mystery Tour before. I'm sure, you know, there were lots of them, but nobody else had got one on the TV on Boxing Day before.
Yeah,
you know, and I suppose this is the interesting thing
on BBC One. I know that's laughable, but like, you know, but actually at the time that's prime time, right? That is the prime time slot for a release like this.
Of course, like what do they, I mean, these days, what do they put on? It's like Doctor Who or yes, like, you know, the yeah. latest Sherlock or something like that. It's the big flagship slot
yeah.
that the BBC want. They put their biggest, shiniest drama property in, or family drama property in. And yeah, and they put the Beatles mucking about in a coach for an hour. It's absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, this is the thing that this is the story we're told, that it was so unpopular, and everyone, you know, as Ringo says in the anthology, you know, they all had the chance then to say, you know, they've gone too far. Who do they think they are? You know, but actually, as with so many of these slightly out there things they did, they've sort of moved the needle along a bit, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, just like we can walk into art galleries and see weird sculptures that don't really conform to traditional ideas of art, and it's not that unusual to us now. But before Yoko Ono started doing that, and her work was sort of popularized through her association with John. You know, all of these things, you know, the Beatles brought a lot of this stuff to mainstream attention. And, you know, so, yeah, arguably part of the reason why it's less complex an idea now to make a film that doesn't have a traditional narrative. because the Beatles mucking around on a coach.
I wonder if also one of the reasons why it's less of an obvious argument to make that this is the Beatles as artists rather than as pop stars is that the six songs that the film chooses to showcase, we don't remember them as being six songs on their own now. I was listening to, and obviously anybody listening to this podcast will obviously already be familiar with Nothing Is Real, which is by any means the default Beatles expert podcast that anybody should be listening to right now. But very, very early on,
we're very hot on their heels, though, I think it's fair to
say. Yeah, yeah. yeah, quaking in their boots, clearly. But very early on, because I remembered when we sat down to watch this film and to record this episode, I remember that they did do an episode on Magical Mystery Tour, albeit more about the actual release, as the EP release, obviously not the film itself. And so I gave that a re-listen. That was very early on in their output, and they made the point, which I hadn't really thought of before, that actually this is the only album, if you want to call it that, by the Beatles where the US version is the one that's stayed as the one that people remember. So we think of Magical Mystery Tour predominantly as containing Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane, Baby You're a Rich Man, and those other sort of more commercial songs.
I don't, but just because the version I have is the two 7-inch
your so old school
EP version they released.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, I've got two of them. One belonged to my aunt, one belonged to my mother, but it's got a chunk out of the vinyl because she dropped it at a bus stop God. In 1967.
Jesus, your mother should know.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Good night. That'll do. I don't think we need to go any further than that. Good stuff.
Just anyway, wait for me sorry, to work no, in. I am the water sir later.
Yeah, I'll do my best. I later got the CD, which does have those songs on it. But I've never had like a. I didn't realize that the 12-inch vinyl, was it released sort of in the 70s or something like that?
I think so, yeah. I'm a little bit less hot on it. I know we've actually had this conversation before a couple of years ago, I think, about what the version that I have, or the version that my parents had, that then was that I used to listen to as a kid and were bestowed onto me later on in life. At what point that became like, well, at what point is that considered an original? Because it's not the original EP release. I mean, you know, anything to do with Beatle vinyl releases, album releases and stuff, I think there's a whole quagmire of issues around what you consider to be the original and whatnot. But I feel like generally now, whether or not you think that is the original Magical Mystery Tour, I think if there was to be a re-release of that album, it's most likely going to contain those extra songs that were part of the US Capitol release. Those feel like they're kind of entwined with the idea of the album as a whole.
Well, I only disagree because I'm familiar with a different version. But
you're a hipster from 1967. That's like, this is no, absolutely not. This is not the album as it was intended. Therefore, I refuse to accept that any other version is the real one.
But no, it's not that. What I mean is my opinion on whether those songs are sort of part of it. I'm only going by the fact that's the version I've always owned, and therefore I don't think of Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane and Baby You're a Rich Man and All You Need Is Love is on there as well.
That's right, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah.
I don't think of them being on that album. But it's fine. It doesn't mean they're
it's
not.
Fine. You
know? I suppose it's fine.
but I guess the point I was trying to make, and maybe you've hugely undermined it, is that I wonder if the idea of viewing this film as an artistic endeavor has kind of lost its way a little bit, because we associate the music for Magical Mystery Tour with some bigger commercial hits. Like, and actually, you know, you'd be forgiven for thinking, or someone of a recent generation, who knows how you measure these things these days, but someone of a recent generation, you'd be forgiven for approaching Magical Mystery Tour film and expecting to see Strawberry Fields Forever as one of the songs that's featured within the film. And I think it's not so easy to separate the film as a showcase for these six songs as the eventual larger release that became quite a dominant version of Magical Mystery Tour as an album later on in its, you know, life cycle.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, that version with the extra songs on it has a decent case for being one of their best albums, you know.
Absolutely.
Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane on it. And you know, All You Need Is Love. These are all, you know, proper Blue Album classics, you know. So yeah, you could that would sort of elevate it to that status, I'm sure.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I think it's really hard to talk about any song in the Beatles catalogue as a deep cut. But when I think about Magical Mystery Tour, because I think of it, because I'm familiar with the extended version of the release of that album, or what is known as an album, originally an EP, I think of the deep cuts as being two of my favourite songs by the Beatles, which are Fool in the Hill and Your Mother Should Know, which actually, when you take away the fact that there was an extended version and actually there were just six songs in the original EP release and in this film. They're not really deep cuts, are they? That's like an entire third of the entire release. And but they are brilliant, brilliant songs. And I am able to appreciate this film as something that offers me a visual for songs that I don't necessarily see or hear as much as some of their other tracks, their more widely known tracks, particularly around this time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know what you mean. So, I mean, Fool on the Hill is a pretty self-contained music video, what we get here, right? So, you know, Paul just sort of sods off to France with, I think, Mal and a cameraman, and they just shoot this thing in Nice as the sun is coming up, and nobody is particularly thinking about structure or organization. He apparently, when he went to France, didn't bother taking his passport or any money, but they let him through anyway because he reasons, you know who I am, you know, why do you need to see a picture of me? Which is quite funny. Not just actually,
again, is that like out of interest, sorry, is that a thing that you only know because Paul has said it in a few interviews? Because that feels like, even legally, that feels like that probably didn't happen, but it's a good story.
Well, I mean, possibly, but no, I think it seems to be, it actually, off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you which source it comes from, and there is a decent chance that source is Paul. However, it in my head, it's corroborated. I think it's not the most outlandish thing in the world to have happened in 1967. But when sort of airport security was a lot less, I don't mean that, like, you know, you go to airport security and they're all there like wearing caftans and, like, you know, with like joss sticks and stuff. So yeah, man, yeah, I just go through. what is security anyway? You know, it's just a concept, man.
Whoa.
but no, I think, but it is interesting. So I mean, if that is true, by the way, I do think it's interesting that Paul has been crazily famous now for 4 years or so, I suppose. And if that is true, I don't particularly think of that as an example of a sort of big egomaniac, don't you know who I am kind of thing. I sort of read that more as just the Beatles just sort of, Beatles think differently to other people. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, they just kind of think, you know, similar kind of thing to just, oh, we've met this this sort of Asian mystical guy. We're all getting on a train to Wales to go and hear him speak. Do you want to come? We're just going to go tomorrow. Yeah, fine, whatever. You know, it's just, there's an awful lot of acting on impulse in the Beatles' career. Lots and lots of these little examples. But anyway, sorry. The Fool on the Hill is really kind of self-contained. And I know exactly what you mean. It is completely my backdrop for, it's what I think of when I hear this song as well. But it's also sort of, it's not a sort of crazy out there song, you know. And actually, I suppose, like, Paul's contributions to this album, or to the soundtrack anyway, this, Your Mother Should Know, and Magical Mystery Tour title track, I think, is a sort of collaborative effort with John mainly. But none of these are crazy out there songs. You know, I suppose Paul is, at least as far as the music is concerned, probably not consciously, but he is sort of tethering it to some extent. He's sort of keeping it the sort of melodic, more traditional pop sensibilities. He's sort of keeping all that in check, it seems.
But one of the things that's always really annoyed me is Your Mother Should Know is one of, I have said for a long time, one of my favourite Beatles songs, mainly because it's one of the ones that aren't one of the obvious ones, right? Because, you know, everyone's favourite Beatles song is one that you don't want to say. No one wants to say that their favourite Beatles song is Help, right? Like, it's you have to choose, like, the sort of the lesser known ones. I've always said that that is one of my favourite ones. So it really annoys me that later on in life, I've discovered that that is kind of considered as one of Paul's granny music songs. Because I really don't see that about it at all. I see it, it's obviously a pastiche of a certain style, but I still think of it as quite a modern song.
Right, okay. And now you want me to validate you, is that right?
Basically, yes, yeah. Because, I mean, what's the alternative? Heaven forbid I put it on Twitter. Ask for a poll.
No, you're right. Let's. All right. I won't let you suffer that indignity. No, I agree with you.
That's it. No, that's it. Don't need anything else. That's fine. Cool. Moving on.
Right. <okay. laughs> No, I think you're right. It is. So the two things about your mother should know is that make people think of it that way, i.e. this is a pastiche of a music hall standard, are the video, the part of the Magical Mystery Tour film in which they're doing a choreographed dance routine, which is incredibly funny, by the way. Like, it's great that they're doing it, and they're all dressed up in, like, white dinner jackets and stuff. And the lyrics, which sort of call to mind, I don't know, it makes you think of something like a traditional standard, like Knees Up Mother Brown or something like that,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
You take that away, there is absolutely no music hall in the actual song at all.
Exactly, like, my point. Quite, exactly that.
It's quite unsettling, I think, that song.
Like, yeah.
It's in a
think
minor
of how it
key.
Starts. Think of how it starts.
The vocals are quite kind of spectral, you know.
Yes, yeah, exactly that. That's very sort of otherworldly, right? I completely agree with you what you said there. And that was my point, I guess, in that going back to what we said earlier about how a lot of the time the visuals in this film during the musical segments are completely inseparable from the actual song themselves. Like, I think about this performance when I hear the song, and I guess I came at it song first, but I wonder whether the white tuxedos and the music hall production during this segment has unfairly made the song seem like it's part of a genre that it doesn't really quite belong.
Right. Of a piece with sort of When I'm 64 or Honey Pie,
yes.
Or whatever, that kind of thing.
Yeah, which doesn't seem those quite... Sort of... Yes, exactly. Those are basically the three songs that I think of. Whenever I hear that quote about... when John Lennon says about Paul McCartney's granny music, those are the three songs that I think he's referring to. And I think Your Mother Should Know doesn't fit quite as squarely into that category.
No, I agree. There's a lot of these songs that... It's kind of testament to the strength of the material that they put out in general, that this is this film and this project is generally seen as a bit of a flop, but the songs, no one's saying, oh, I can't stand the songs on it, you know.
Yeah.
Think about the title track, Magical Mystery Tour. I think that's often overlooked quite a lot as a song, like, you know, as you do with Your Mother Should Know. A friend of mine once described it to me as a great drinking song, Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah, that's a really good way of thinking about it. I hadn't thought about it before.
Yes, I really like that description of it. You can really imagine being in a crowded pub and that coming on the jukebox and everyone really going for it. Do you know what I mean?
It's
quite a funny way to describe a song kind of associated with psychedelia as well.
It is a very strangely evocative song of a particular thing, like in the same way that I think Sgt. Pepper's works, you know. Sgt. Pepper's, you know, the idea of this being this band, this show band, and this concept of that, like the actual Magical Mystery Tour, this idea of it having a bit of a fairground feel to it, a bit of a sort of I love you using the word ramshackle, but this idea of a ramshackle tour guide feel to it, like it feels like it really invokes a particular scenario.
I think it's got that in common with Sgt. Pepper, as you say. Like, it, and also the other thing it has in common with Sgt. Pepper the song is that it lyrically, when you listen to them in the absence of the concept, i.e. the film or the concept, supposed concept album that they're a part of. Lyrically, they don't really make any sense. Well, they make sense in and of themselves, but you think, what tour are you going on about? You know, so if you didn't know they did a film, it's like, well, these guys have done this song called Magical Mystery yeah. Tour. Give it a listen. Yeah, all right, fine. You give it a listen. Okay. Roll up for what? Why are you? Oh, okay. Yeah, fine. I mean, it's a good song, but great. You know, yeah. They are kind of apart from that. Whereas, like, you know, the Fool on the Hill is a song that could fit, you know, on any Beatles album in terms of.
Yeah, you're right. It's really interesting because, like, Magical Mystery Tour, I've always seen. Is it? Do you know, you're closer to this stuff than I am, but is Magical Mystery Tour normally seen as some kind of conceptual partner to Sgt. Pepper? Because in my mind, that's how I've always perceived it.
No, I don't think so. No, I think it's more just that they were the two main things that they did in 1967, and they're the two sort of most consciously psychedelic of the two. So, you know, if you go and see the bootleg Beatles, they will almost always, I think we've seen them do both, but they'll open the second half either with Sgt. Pepper or with Magical Mystery Tour to introduce, like, the psychedelic bit. And that is all. And that is all 1967 stuff, really. I'm not sure there's anything. It's weird that, isn't it? I think we've spoken before about that thing of, you know, in my mind, you know, on sort of 1st of January 1968, everyone just sort of threw all their colourful clothes in the bin, you know, and just started dressing a bit more soberly, you know, and just stopped taking LSD and all the rest of it. You know, of course, it's not the case, but
which was unfortunate, because if they did that on the 1st of January 1968, 4 days later, on the 5th of January 1968, is when Magical Mystery Tour, the film, was actually shown in colour on BBC Two. So maybe that was why it also received a critical backlash at that point, because it was just 4 days too late.
There was also the fact that not a lot of people had colour TVs, to be honest. So, you know, they were fighting a losing battle.
That's true, actually, yeah. So, but I guess going back to that point, I don't want to go into this too much because it didn't necessarily pertain to the film itself, but I always think of Magical Mystery Tour as being like a follow-up to Sgt. Pepper's, because I think it's the approach to the recordings are the same. So you have this introductory song that introduces the concept, and then there are some songs. And then I guess there's debate about whether or not those songs follow that concept, but arguably, you know, you've already introduced it at that point. And Magical Mystery does that. And one of the things that I was thinking about when I was rewatching this film for this episode is that I've always kind of thought of, sometimes subconsciously, I think, I've always kind of thought of Magical Mystery Tour as being a bit of a darker cousin to Sgt. Pepper. Like, Sgt. Pepper's, like, it has a similar kind of style, similar kind of music style, but Magical Mystery Tour feels a little bit like it's a little bit more twisted. And so when I was rewatching the film, I was like, I wonder if that's because I don't know if that's necessarily apparent in the songs themselves. So I wonder if I feel that way because of the film. Because the film at times definitely seems nightmarish. Mm. Like, it feels very, like, there is some really, you know, just nonsensical laughter at inane things is quite hellish in some ways. And so I wonder if that's where I'm getting that sort of sensibility from.
Yeah, maybe. You know, I think what I was thinking when I was watching I'm the Walrus on this is, you know, the reason why I think this is so challenging, the way it's presented and the song itself, is that it sort of, they've got this, it starts very abruptly, by the way. It interrupts and what you think is going to be another scene. They're doing one of these. The guy at the Buster Blood Vessel is standing at the front saying, you know, enjoy yourselves within the limits of British decency. You know what I mean, don't you? well, don't you, you know? And they all go, yes, Mr. Blood Vessel. And then it just starts very, very abruptly. Anything, you know, and so you bear in mind, this is the first time the world hears I Am the Walrus. No one's ever heard this before. And they've heard the Beatles be a bit out there before, but this is just full on nonsense, doggerel lyrics. And these, I always think the sort of string arrangement on it is, that is potentially quite nightmarish, to use your word. It's a really good word for it, because I do think that there's a lot in this where it's mixed very loud. You've got these weird, you know, you've got the sort of King Lear bits from the radio coming in and out and all this kind of stuff. And it's just crazy. And this is what I mean, is that this is potentially quite scary. You know, this is the sort of thing that, you know, and again, this is Boxing Day tea time. This is all, you know.
Yeah, right, yeah.
It's a really nutty decision, the whole thing.
Do you know, if I'm unfamiliar, but just on the off chance, it's worth asking you, do you know if there are any interpretations that have been proposed for either the song or the actual visual musical segment of the song? Are you aware of any sort
interpretations?
Of interpretations? Yeah, yeah. Like, as in, like, why? Why those visuals? I guess the visuals, I guess, are in keeping with the lyrics. But you know, it feels like it's the kind of thing that I imagine a film class studying for weeks and writing dissertations about. And that entire class would be very disappointed to hear John Lennon or Paul McCartney, or to unearth some interview with Paul McCartney where it's just like, yeah, we just found some walrus masks in a box somewhere, so we just wrote a song, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. This is the thing. You know, the thing. I'm often reminded of actually, you know, more than one conversation we've had as part of this podcast. I'm often reminded of, you know, when you're a teenager and you have to do Shakespeare, right? And you have to study Shakespeare, right? And at some point, some kid in your class, you know, you're being told, like, there's this and there's the symbolism, and what are the key themes? What themes was Shakespeare going for? And some kid in your class, you know, GCSE level, we'll just go like, I can't believe he actually like did all this stuff deliberately, right? You know, like, he's just written a story and then we're all here interpreting it and putting all this stuff in it, you know. And
we've never had this conversation, by the way. We've never had this conversation as part of this podcast or anywhere else outside of this podcast. But I do agree with you. Like, this is something that has definitely happened. Like, I think about this a lot as someone who then went on to study English literature. Like, this constant point that was always made in the classroom, it was like, there's no way he decided to do that.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I think this is the thing with, by the way, I mean, to study the Beatles is comparable to studying Shakespeare, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of their sort of cultural impact. So it's interesting that there is a lot of what did they mean by this? You know, what was
I like how it's comparable as far as you're concerned, but not, we should make clear, as comparable as far as UCAS is concerned.
No, that is true. although there's a university doing Beatles studies now, isn't there?
Of course there is. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'd bloody love to choose that. That'd be great.
That'd be great. Just take a year off work.
Making those choices now.
That'd be brilliant.
I tell you what, it'd make this podcast a lot easier.
Definitely would.
Just come with the answers. I assume there's an answer to all of it.
Yeah, oh, there's an answer to all of it. Yeah, there's there'll be York notes to all the albums, you know, for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you massively.
But no, I think with something like I Am the Walrus is so it's so kind of out there that it's obviously open to interpretation. Now, you know, Lennon said years later that he, you know, it was just kind of, those were nonsense lyrics, and he was sort of in his Lewis Carroll phase, you know. And yes, maybe I suppose if you take a look at those lyrics, you can see there are some themes in there and themes that we've discussed before with films like Wonderwall and with The Magic Christian, this idea of sort of the sort of staid British society being disrupted, you know. And I suppose there are lyrics, you know, being a naughty girl, you let your knickers down, that kind of thing. You know, these are salacious and also, again, you know, quite challenging. You know, I mean, there are things in the film itself that sort of play into those themes. You know, that sort of preoccupation with pricking the foolishness of British establishment figures. So you think of Victor Spinetti, the sergeant major, who is fantastic, by the way, just never actually says any words.
Yes.
Yeah. He just makes noises like a sergeant major does.
Yeah.
It's a Python performance 2 years before Python.
You know? Exactly that, yeah.
And but then his bubble is just, he's saying all this, well, he's not saying anything, but he's making all these noises and he's being so sergeant majorish. And Ringo just says, "Why?" You know, and Spinetti just goes, "What? Why? What? Like, his whole reason for being has just been shown up as valueless, you know. And it's the same thing as the train commuter in A Hard Day's Night saying, "I fought the war for the likes of you. I bet you're sorry you won." You know, it's the same thing. And over and over again, there's this thing of sort of British establishment figures being undermined in some way and having their value system not quite mocked, but at least challenged in a public way, you know.
When you're approaching this film as we know that the Beatles have done, or if you want to go down the route of Paul McCartney is the driving force of this film, why has he gone down this route of including a scene where there is an army commander that is just spewing nonsense out there? Like, why is that relevant? At what point is it somebody trying to say this is relevant to the film, or this is relevant to the music, or this is just something that is fun that would be quite good? And I kind of assumed that it was just a bit of fun, and if I'm being honest, probably goes on a bit too long. But you're right, actually, that does play into this idea of there being sort of an anti-British establishment thing, where you're holding up this sort of typical character of someone who is an authority figure and making fun of him. In a way that is, you know, contemporary of the time and very surrealistic of the time. But, you know, it's surrealistic in the sense that I think the ultimate goal of that entire scene is for him to show a crowd of people how to attack a stuffed cow. But yeah, you're right. Actually, there's a sort of a general through line, I think, for that scene to exist in a film, and the general approach that the film has in overall, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, and bear in mind as well, you know, this entire thing is an English coach trip, you know, which is a sort of traditional thing of sort of British people going off to see it to a seaside town for the day or an overnight trip or something like that, and taking a crate of brown ale with them, you know. You know, this is as English as can be on the surface of it. But then, you know, the whole thing is disrupted by the sort of more psychedelic avant-garde elements, you know. So it's using that structure of the sort of the most British things you can think of, you know, and then upending them, basically.
Exactly that, yeah. I think that's right. And in that way, I think it's actually quite heartening, I think, to think that we can sort of dig out a little bit of a thematic consistency to the film that on the surface maybe doesn't appear to have one. Just quickly, you mentioned earlier about literally the line "let your knickers down." I had to pull up a transcript from the supposed, everyone calls it as a apology that Paul McCartney makes to David Frost. They call it an apology, but it's literally just him, it's defense, I think, isn't it, of him explaining that actually, as far as he's concerned, he liked the film, so why should anyone else care? There is a point in it where David Frost asks him, can it be a success when people don't like it? And he says, he basically says that, you know, if he woke up and there were rave reviews, then they'd have all said it's a success and he wouldn't have been on tonight talking to him. But then he literally goes on to say, but it doesn't matter all that much because people said about two of our records, like Strawberry Fields and I Am the Rawers, to name but two. They said, those are terrible, you know. You can't talk about Let Your Knickers Down on telly. You can't do it, but you can, you know. I've just done it. Which I liked. It's almost like...
doesn't he also say in that interview, like, the Queen's speech wasn't such a gas,
yes,
you know?
Yes, it does. Like that. Yes, right, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes that comparable.
Yeah, yeah. It's really funny, like, all this stuff, you know, you think also about the, you know, his LSD interview that, you know, we've discussed before in another episode, you know. You think it is crazy that this narrative was allowed to develop, that this guy was not challenging, this guy was not provocative. There's incredibly provocative things to do, you know, in terms of like national media appearances.
Yeah.
To, you know, to sort of like, you know, he's not kind of slagging off the Queen, but he is saying a thing that people didn't really say in public that much.
Yeah, that's funny though, isn't it? But also, you know, like,
and again, it's a totem of Britishness. And it's kind of sacrosanct, and he's kind of chipping away at it a little bit.
You know? But also, you know, I know it's obvious, but you should call these things out as they are. That nowadays, I read a transcript of that, or I watch that interview now, and it's like, it's just a guy saying, this is all I wanted to do. Like, you know, like, it's not, you know, why, like, he's so casual with it, you know, like, I just wonder, it makes me think, like, is he the first person that's had to deal with media uproar and paparazzi attention where suddenly, you know, the Beatles have failed because they've released this film and it's not been a success. And he's like, yeah, I thought it was all right. So what's the problem? As in, you know, I thought it was all right. And that's his entire defense of the whole thing. It was like, you know, I asked around, we were in a room, and we were like, yeah, we thought it was fine. So, you know, what's the problem? You know, like, and if you don't like it, who cares, basically? Like, I don't know. It seems nuts to me that he was called in, he was asked to justify something that was being called into question when it's just it's an artistic endeavor. It's like you know, any number of films or songs or anything now that are decided to be flops by critics, and then that having media, like, massive front page news media attention on them, and have, you know, we're recording this at a time when Avatar 2 is coming out in cinemas, right? Like, imagine it being front page news that James Cameron is having to defend that Avatar 2 might not be as good as Avatar 1. And, you know, everyone's on tenterhooks to find out how on earth is he possibly going to justify that this sequel to his earlier supposedly greater work is, you know, is actually technically as good. How can he justify the critical backlash that the film has received or whatever, you know? Just, I don't know, maybe it's just the first of its kind.
Well, maybe. But I think also, like, it's difficult for us to appreciate probably just what a huge part of the British cultural landscape the Beatles made themselves so quickly. In terms of the sort of... we think about the sort of tabloid stories that go on these days. They'll generally be sort of, I don't know, at any one time... sort of four or five different sort of bête noire that the tabloids are going after, or people who are sort of generally being discussed or are getting themselves in the papers or whatever. I'm not saying the Beatles were like the only celebrities in town, but they were certainly the biggest, and they were certainly, you know, and also like there had never been a pop group. It's sort of 5 years ago, pop music was just, as far as the public were concerned, it was for kids, and it, you know, it was of no value, and it was like, you know, bubblegum, and it was completely disposable, and no pop group had ever stuck around for any length of time. It wasn't the point of it. And so, and all, you know, sort of 5 years later, they're on the TV on Boxing Day, you know. And I suppose you can kind of see in the context of that sort of media landscape that it's like, well, we've put these guys on the BBC on Boxing Day and they've given us this? Explain yourselves.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And we're going to pause things there. This is the end of part one of our two-part episode on Magical Mystery Tour. So join us again next week where we will release the second part of the same discussion, and we will see you then. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.